This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello and welcome to BC This Week, some of the best radio from in and around British Columbia from CBC Radio. I'm Lee Rosevere. Earlier this week, at around 11:30 a.m. on Sunday, the jury in the 10-month-long Robert Picton trial reached their verdict. The 12-member jury had found him guilty on 6 counts of second-degree murder, and Picton will receive a life sentence. Friends and families of the missing women are still coming to terms with the conviction, and here's how they reacted to the news outside the courthouse in New Westminster after the decision.
It was a little disappointing that they weren't all first-degree murder counts, but nonetheless, we do have the life convictions that we need to keep this very dangerous predator in jail for the rest of his life.
We wanted to face the person who committed this horrible crime, so we're really, really glad that we were able to be in the courtroom to see. He didn't move. He didn't flinch when those verdicts came in at all. When you hear the words guilty by 12 people who were neutral and made their decision solely on the evidence, it was amazing. We cheered. we were hugging each other and crying.
I'm Mona Wilson's sister. I hope he's listening at the moment, you know, that because it took me a lot of years to get up here and want to say what I have to say, that he's taken a lot away from me. He's got no idea. To me, it doesn't seem fair because he's still alive and she's not. But now, you know what? Mona's family, me, can finally lay her to rest.
It's just sad. You know, like, you took my mom away and, like, I'm never going to have her back, no matter what, so.
I'm actually sitting here crying. From living on the downtown east side, I have my reasons to believe that it's first degree. At least I know he will go to jail and he won't get out and reoffend. I mean, that's the important part.
I'm just grateful that it's over, and I hope that this brings some closure for the families, and by that I mean blood families and the street family. I think we've all been really anxious, wondering what's going to happen here. People are rarely convicted of crimes against us. And so this really is a big relief.
I try to be strong with the other family members. And, you know, I accept the fact that she's gone. She's in the arms of God right now and resting.
May the path be lit by the light of all the girls in this trial to help lead the way. Now, to all the people who helped bring us to this point in time, may God bless you all. And to all the people who look the other way and still do as these girls continue to go missing over and over again, may God save your soul.
Back in downtown Vancouver, the CBC's Sherelle Tobin spoke with people in front of the Carnegie Community Center and Main and Hastings as they listened and waited to hear what the verdict would be.
He had no right to do what he did. I hope he fries. And that's all I have to say.
I've worked the streets and I've done the stroll and I've never had anything bad happen. But those girls weren't so lucky. And I think he took away sisters, mothers. He deserves to get the worst, man. He did it. He needs to take responsibility for what he did.
And the problem is, he used to be down here, right over in that hotel. Okay, that's how he knew all them. You know, and he knew the kind of life they led, and he knew the horrors of their life. And then to turn around and do that, I mean, these girls suffered on the street all their lives, you know, working the streets, you know, their self-esteem going lower and lower and lower and hopeless, and, you know, and for him to know that and do that and use them as, you know, it's just unthinkable.
How does it feel to be waiting?
Emotional.
Oh, nervous. I hope it comes up with the right verdict. You know, we all want justice.
Feel nervous about the verdict?
Of course. I mean, I've been working on the streets since I was 12 years old. I could have been one of those girls, could have been me, right? Scary, that's all, hey?
Serena asked, wait, count one. The information I have is guilty.
Yes!
Yes!
Guilty.
All the
information
I have is
guilty.
Guilty. Guilty
of second degree.
Second degree! Woohoo!
Yes, thank you. Excellent. This is a good thing.
Happy that this verdict has come in. I waited a long time. It's justice being served. Unfortunately, we do not have the death penalty.
Second degree, it's abominable. I think there's too much evidence against this man, and it should have been hands down. First degree, mandatory life, 25, and I don't think he should ever get out of the highest security.
Reaction from the Picton verdicts continued all week here in British Columbia as his sentencing was announced on Tuesday. Here's Rick Clough from the Early Edition.
As you know, Robert Picton will be sentenced later today after facing guilty verdicts on 6 charges of second-degree murder. He faces another 20 murder charges. If found guilty, he would be the worst serial killer in Canadian history. Now, Kim Rossmo was the detective inspector in charge of the VPD's geographic profiling section in the late 1990s.
Well, in 1998, as a result of information that was coming from the community to the patrol sector of the Vancouver Police Department, I was asked to take a look at the information that was available. And at that time, there were a number of missing women, I believe about 27. And any explanation for that phenomena had to explain why it was only women, why no bodies were being found, why it wasn't happening before 1995, and why it wasn't happening in some other Canadian skid roads. And the only explanation I could come up with for all that was a serial killer. Unfortunately, the major crime section of the Vancouver Police Department at that time didn't agree with that theory. The other side of it is that if these had been women from the west side of Vancouver, there would have been a very different police response. And that's, you know, frustrating, and it obviously led to some low level of activity or insufficient deployment of resources by both the Vancouver Police Department and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Both agencies, I would have to say, fumbled the ball. If another Picton comes along tomorrow, will the same thing happen again, or will the police be able to respond more effectively and efficiently? That's the key question.
That was former Detective Inspector Kim Rossmo. So how does Robert Picton fit into the profile of a serial killer, and what motivated him? Elliot Layton is one of the world's leading experts on serial murderers, and he is the author of Hunting Humans, The Rise of the Modern Multiple Murderer. And he's on the line with us now. Dr. Layton, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of Kim Rossmo's assessment of how police handled the investigation into these missing women on the Downtown East Side?
Well, Kim is bang on. He's the only doctorate in the entire force. He's a man of education and very high quality, and it's a great pity that his words were not heeded. The only comment I'd make on that particular tape, if your audience heard it, is that this had been going on much before the mid-90s, and that many of us in the business were aware by the early to mid-80s that women were disappearing, too.
How useful do you think a public inquiry might be, then, in trying to prevent this from happening again?
Well, I personally think it's vital to not only to clear the air, but to find out how such a scandalous indifference to so many people disappearing could possibly take place. This is the worst case I can think of in Canadian history of really neglectful policing. And it was systemic. It wasn't just the police doing nothing. It was the entire community, whether the public or the authorities. I mean, there's no level at which there was any action. Nothing. Despite all the pressure groups from the people representing sex workers, the people speaking on behalf of women, they knew also in the 80s that something very wrong was going on, and no one would pay them any attention. They were treated with utter and absolute contempt. It's disturbing.
Why do you think that was?
Well, Kim hinted at it, and he's quite right. I mean, when you have it's an ugly kind of racism, sexism, and classism coming together in this whole case. These unfortunate women were at the sharp edge of the nasty stick that's in this country and in every country. Many of them were Aboriginals, so they're victims of racism, and most of them were sex or drug addicted prostitutes. And I mean, that you can't get any lower on the the commons people's popularity poll than that. So, I mean, they just were in the invisible ones. They were the people who don't matter, the worthless ones. So if they began to disappear, then no one would raise an eyelid. And that's exactly what happened for years and years and years. It's just no one seemed to care. It wasn't malevolent. It wasn't malicious. It was just cold indifference.
Picton wrote in a letter to a prison pen pal back in 2006 that he thought he was put on earth to rid people of their evil ways. Is that typical? Is that the typical kind of motivation you hear from serial killers?
Oh, I've often heard that sort of thing. Just off the top of my head, Carl Panzram talked the same way in the 20s, and the Yorkshire Ripper talked away the same way. It's a fantasy they have that justifies, or in their minds, what they've done, and it gives them a level of self-exoneration.
You've written that all serial killers are in fact themselves social outcasts in some way, but I mean, many people would be considered outcasts, but not all are killers. So what separates the killers from the others?
The depths of their anger and their depths of their willingness to see other human beings as toys. You know, most of us could not dream of killing because we see that the other person is a human being. But once you have a personality that is not only a sexual sadist, but sees other human beings as just objects to use for your own pleasure, when you get that combined and the opportunity, then these chaps can form and go ahead and begin their murderous enterprises.
Are we getting any better at identifying and tracking serial killers?
Oh, I think so. The DNA thing, of course, was the major discovery of the 20th century in the criminal field. But while hunting down a serial killer is inherently difficult because there's no prior social or economic relationship with the victim, they're usually strangers that they're killing, hunting them down remains as difficult, but there are more and more tools. And as long as the will is there in the from the mayor's office to the police administration, as long as the will is there to see what's going on, to begin surveillance of any suspicious situation, and then begin an intensive investigation of missing women or missing people, then it can be much more effective than it was, yes.
And finally, Doctor, can you put these six verdicts into context for us when it comes to serial murders in Canada?
Well, there haven't been that many serial killers, thank heavens, in this country. This is by far the most prolific case in Canada, the most prolific murder case, and it's one of the most prolific murder cases, serial murder cases ever. So it's especially anywhere in the world. I mean, the serial killers who killed the most, claimed the most victims, run around these numbers, whether it's in the United States or in Ukraine, Russia, and so on. So this is really an especially horrendous case, and I hope to heavens that's the end of this kind of lackadaisical approach to dealing with them. And as for the sentences, well, I'm both bitterly disappointed and delighted, because I was terrified. From my contacts in Vancouver were all telling me there was a real chance that there was going to be a hung jury and that he might even get off. So it's great that he got a second degree thing, and I assume he'll get some kind of life sentence. But there is a sense of injustice, too, that this man knew what he was doing and kept doing it, and a first-degree murder verdict might have been more appropriate. But still, it remains. I think it's an acceptable compromise verdict, and it should be the beginning of a lot of new things.
Elliot Layton, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now an unlikely connection between Prince George and Nashville, Tennessee, a name that's synonymous with country music, and a town that lives in the dreams of many aspiring stars. And since she was a little girl, Karen Carter has wanted to record in Nashville, and last weekend she got her chance. Karen Carter lives in Chetwynd, but Chris Walker spoke to her in the Prince George CBC studio.
Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
Why did you go to Nashville, Tennessee?
I went to Nashville, Tennessee to record songs to follow a dream that I've had since I was a young girl. And I was presented with an opportunity 8 years ago to be in a talent competition with the particular promotional company that I'm dealing with now. I didn't get to go then, but just something told me to follow that dream again and contact these people and find out what was happening now. And I was in the hopes of maybe they were having another talent competition, and they usually hold those in the summer, which would have gave me proper time to get prepared and find a good song and maybe impress some big wigs down there.
It's a gutsy move to call up producers out of the blue.
Well, yes, but for some reason God put it into my head. He said, just do it, and I did, and it resulted in something absolutely fabulous.
What's your earliest memory of wanting to be a country singer?
Well, I'd have to say when I was a young teenager, I would be out in the fields with the horses, getting them rounded up for their nightly dealings with feeding and whatnot, and I'd be out there singing away, just thinking, man, would it ever be nice to be able to do this for the whole world.
So when you went down to Nashville, Tennessee on the weekend, just take us through what that was like. What was the studio like, first of all?
The studio was very, very comfortable. You walk in the door and you see a nice little kitchenette area seating. It's really cozy, and the people are really very easy to get, you know and work with. We had a fabulous time.
And what was the recording process like? Was it what you expected?
Well, I actually, quite frankly, didn't know what to expect. Huh. It was all new to me, so I just took it as it came along and just worked with what they told me to do.
What did you think of Nashville, the city? Certainly it's been the mecca of country stars for years and years and years. What did you think of Nashville as a town?
Well, I for what I got to see, I enjoyed very much. I went down to 2nd and Broadway, which is the main strip, basically, where all the entertainment places are. And I got to visit some of those places on the Saturday evening and the Sunday.
Now, there are lots of recordings that come out of Nashville. Lots and lots and lots of recordings that come out of Nashville that some of them become hits. A small minority become hits. Whether or not your record is commercially successful, what will you take away from the experience of going down to Nashville and recording this music?
Well, just the fact that I got to realize my dream, that I got to go in and record some songs and have a professional studio do these songs and make them sound really great. I heard the results, and they are just fabulous.
For young people who might be listening who are chasing their dreams, whether it's in music or any other vocation, what's your message to young people who have a dream far off in their distant future that they want to achieve?
All I can say is don't let go of it. Just, you know, even if you don't get to do it right away, make sure you don't let go of it and take every opportunity to make it happen for you.
Will you do us the favor of singing a little bit for us?
I could do a bit of a song that I recorded, sure.
Karen Carter.
Every time we touch, I feel a spark that goes right through my body, straight into my heart. Tonight the sky is filled with stars, but I don't have a wish. They all came true the first time that we kissed. Loving you the way I do, I'd give you the moon if I knew how. And I am sure no one before could love you more than I do now. Till forever runs out of time, I will spend my life loving you.
Lovely. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Chris.
Any relation to June?
You know, I think I'm going to have a few people wondering who I'm related to down there with my last name. And it's going to be fun to tell them I'm not really sure. We'll
Karen,
have to look up the history.
Thanks again for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, that wraps up another edition of BC This Week for December 15th, 2007. Next week on the program, we'll be taking a little bit of a vacation with the all-music holiday edition of BC This Week. If you have any comments or questions, you can always write to us at bcpodcast@cbc.ca. Thanks for downloading us. I'm Lee Rosevere.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.